Hello and welcome to Minted Dialogue episode number 133. This interview is with Tim Spark, partner at Congregation Partners, helping brands and agencies with their communications. In this podcast, we discuss the challenges that advertising agencies face in this digital world, how companies need to evolve to enhance their digital know-how, accepting a test and learn culture, branding, new creative processes for running campaigns, the language of digital and business, and much more. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the Minted Dialogue podcast, where we discuss brand marketing with a focus on all things digital. I am Minted Dial, your host and author of The Mindset. That's MYNDSET.com, where branding gets personal. You'll find the show notes to the blog for the upcoming interview. Let's cut to the quick and enjoy the show.
So, Tim, tell us who you are and what you do.
My name's Tim Spark. I am a partner at a small consultancy business in London called Congregation Partners. And we basically help brands and agencies evolve their comms output in line with emerging channels and new opportunities.
So when I first met you, I was highly recommended to meet you, Tim. What struck me as interesting about Congregation Partners is that you have a pool of very different expertises that you bring to the table. Tell us a little bit more about the types of people that you bring into your projects.
Brilliant. So we basically sort of have three aspects to the business. We look at the strategy, the approach you've got to digital communications. We look at the people you've got and potentially the people you might need. So we'll often do sort of a headhunting and general recruitment. And then we look at the knowledge levels within the business to work out of the people you've got, how can we improve their confidence, reduce their sense of fear and confusion, uncertainty and doubt around new opportunities in mobile, social and the digital space.
When you founded Congregation Partners, what was the stimulation? Because it sounds very complex to be bringing in all these different elements into a project.
I think the plan was based around the idea that, for example, recruitment in isolation doesn't work. You can take phenomenal digital talent and parachute them into a traditional agency, and we've spent 5 years watching these people flounder and really struggle because there was no buy-in from the top, there'd be no investment at the middle level, and culturally the agency wouldn't quite be ready. So when we look at projects, we generally look at, we do an audit initially, work out what the knowledge levels are, work out what the current output can be, and then we'll try and define what the ambition is. So what's the approach we want to take and what kind of work do we actually aspire to? If you look at training on its own, again, you can sort of improve people's knowledge levels, but fundamentally, if they go back to work and none of the culture or the sort of the talent's changed, then again, that training's only going to have a limited effect. So actually, a lot of the time, we can work on specific projects which just are around improving people's confidence and understanding, but a lot of the time we'll actually be thinking, what's the generic culture? What's the culture of the business? How do they behave? It goes across every aspect of it, from the top right down to the most junior people in the business, what you can change and what people need to do about it.
So we're in the change business, you and I, and you have not necessarily only this, but you have a lot of clients that are in the agency world. Tell us a little bit about what specific is about working in the agency world.
So I used to work at a digital agency called Agency Republic. They were 5 times Marketing Agency of the Year in London. They were phenomenal. And this was at the point when we thought the agencies, the digital agencies, were going to take over the big incumbents and we'd be the future. Mm-hmm. Sadly, that's not quite what happened. What we actually saw happen was a lot of the talent would be raided from the digital agencies. They'd be parachuted into these big network or creative shops, and I would then get a phone call very soon afterwards saying, help, we need to improve the knowledge levels, we need to improve people's understanding of the opportunities. And from that kind of was the spur that I needed to set up Congregation, actually, to move into creating my own consultancy business.
Well, so if I listen to you, I think of the challenges that big businesses are having in integrating digital. So they might hire a chief digital officer, a senior geek. In the same way, when a big agency tries to insert digital knowledge into the agency, what are some of the challenges that they face in bringing that together?
for the agency.
Yes.
So again, you often don't see that cultural shift. When I was at Republic, we had a very collaborative flat structure. Ideas could come from anywhere, and it was a very sort of non-hierarchical basis for the business. And that worked really well in producing sort of great integrated and digital comms. But if you look at the way agencies are generally founded and structured, you'll generally have a sort of a totemic inspirational creative director who'll found it, or sort of a great thinker at the heart of it, and then everything sort of flows from there. And actually what I found is, having initially worked at, my first job was for Yamaha Musical Instruments, a very structured hierarchical Japanese company. I then moved to Apple for 5 years, which is a far, still hierarchical, but more networked, more collaborative environment. And then to go back to a traditional, a digital ad agency that actually sort of was structured in quite a traditional manner, it seemed very old-fashioned. Mm. One might say almost Victorian. And there's this, there's an anthropologist called E.O. Wilson, who I'm absolutely obsessed by. He has this wonderful phrase, which is, the trouble is we have Neanderthal emotions and minds, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. And so what you have is this situation where we're surrounded by phenomenally powerful technology, and yet the structures and the institutions and the companies we work with often function in a very traditional, almost 15th century style way.
One of the things I wanted to dig in with, it may not be your specific area within Congregation, but the motivations and the remunerations of people in an agency seems also not to have followed the evolution. We talked about hierarchy, we talk about top down, and yet people still need to get paid for doing a job. Have you any ideas as to how to improve the way we remunerate, reward, recognize individuals and agencies for participating in a less hierarchical environment?
It's quite a big question. Most agencies will try different remuneration models. Lots of people want to get into moving away from comms into solving business challenges, coming up with new products that they can sell and market themselves. We run an interesting sort of program called the Friday Club, where we put startups and marketeers together, and the brand marketers basically spend half a day a month trying to help startups solve their sort of marketing and comms issues. I honestly haven't seen any particular models in terms of remuneration that work particularly well. I mean, the agencies are still sold on a time-based basis, which is insane. It makes absolutely no sense. There's no incentive to solve problems quickly, and there's huge issues with the agency wants to sell more people for more time, and the brand is coming from obviously a very different place.
When I listened to you before about the creative director, who of course is usually somewhat of a pacha in the midst, to what extent is it important for that creative director to be digitally connected? Because usually they have an aesthetic eye, they're paid to be creative, and they come with a certain experience, but may not be digitally connected.
You would have thought the creatives would be the most curious, most interested in new opportunities group of people within any sort of a creative agency. In my experience, and I may not win any friends here, they're often the blockage. They're often not particularly interested in new opportunities. Some of this is because, you know, often they'll come from a background which is, they're sometimes frustrated film directors who, you know, like Tony Scott or Ridley Scott, want to make their own movies at the end of it. So every answer to every brief is generally a sort of a 30-second TV spot with a view to sort of...
winning at Cannes.
Yeah, winning at Cannes. And I just, yeah, it's just interesting to see the level of, I think, because they're expected to be the most creative, the most curious people within the organization, a lot of the time they just don't, you know, that's almost puts them into some position of freeze. They just freeze and think, right, okay, I don't know about this. I don't, you know, I've got no interest for it. And it's the classic sort of it's just what the kids are up to. It's not relevant for me. It's not relevant for my audience. And I think, you know, the really smart people, and sometimes we always get there in the end. You know, you always win, and whether it's just getting them to start using Twitter or starting up a social media listening post, just getting them to engage in this stuff, it's, you know, you always get there, but the barriers are really, really fascinating. And, you know, if I was to say I try and do one thing more than anything else, it's basically just try and encourage people to be curious about what's happening. All my favorite people in advertising feel ridiculously insecure about their knowledge levels. And they're generally some of the smartest people you'll ever come across. But actually, they sit there and worry about not knowing enough, just not being aware of new emerging behaviors or new emerging sort of technologies. And actually, I think that fear is sort of quite a wonderful and powerful thing in terms of sort of driving us forward and giving us that sort of that understanding of what the opportunities are out there. So I think part of it's encouraging people to be curious. Part of it's encouraging people to have the confidence to challenge people, to ask the right questions. You know, I run a course which is called The Language of Digital, which is basically for the whole organization to agree a certain amount of language that they'll use when they're talking about technology. You get rid of as much jargon as possible. You have the confidence of anyone in the business can challenge people and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. You're right. Just trying to confuse and...
Right, so drill down on that one. So what is too geeky? Hashtag?
No, hashtag's fine. But the thing is, it's not whether it's geeky or not. It's just... When I first started at Apple, I was the lead music software trainer in the UK for Logic, which is their music production suite. And for the first 2 weeks of my job, I would basically face these incredibly smart musicians who were using the software every day, and they'd come in and baffle me with these sort of bamboozling, long, convoluted questions about technology. And after about 2 weeks, I wanted to resign and leave, and I just thought, I'm not qualified to do this job. And then I went through a process of just pushing back quickly on some of the questions they'd ask and just challenging them a bit and trying to work out what the nub of the issue really was. And you suddenly realize if they can't succinctly explain what the problem is, they're just very confused and they don't really understand what the problem is, and therefore they can't see the solution. And once you just start listening a bit more, you start pushing back and probing with various questions, all became clear. And I think it's exactly the same when it comes to technology and communications and marketing. We have a situation where we traditionally had the geeks who knew the stuff, and they would obfuscate and confuse as a way of selling in inappropriate ideas and inappropriate solutions to people who had just been told we need to spend 20% of our budgets on digital this year, which is a fatuous, ridiculous thing for any business to do.
So agree with you.
Yeah, I had a client 2 years ago, and they said, you know, I've got a £20 million budget in the UK. What proportion of that should be spent on digital? And it's, you know, I was like, A, you're not paying me enough to answer that question, and B, you know, it's a ridiculous question. It doesn't make any sense. What's the business context? What's the objectives you got?
Your audience on digital?
Is your audience on digital? You know, and I think we've gone, you know, my big frustration is we've sort of, as an industry, we get very excited by new technologies and we tend to all chase the same opportunities. So, you know, I often use the Gartner hype cycle in classes where we just explain, where is the technology on the hype cycle? Is it in the peak of inflated expectations where everyone's jumping around? Okay, we've got to be on Snapchat. Snapchat's the newest platform. That's where we need to be doing stuff. One person will do an isolated piece of work that will work on that particular platform, and then suddenly everyone else sees that as a proof case, and there's a sort of gold rush towards that. So we're all constantly chasing the ball, looking for the same platform. So we went from making Flash microsites 10 years ago that no one visited, to Facebook pages that no one's interested in, through to mobile apps now, which people download. Well, just we spend hundreds of thousands of pounds making, and no one downloads. We know most people...
Well, if they download it, they don't go back to it.
Yeah, and so you know, I'm not anti-experimentation. I think experimentation is the best thing a brand can do, trying these things. But you need to learn from it. You need to actually sort of learn from where things went wrong rather than just having that culture of blaming the person when it went wrong, trying to sort of brush it under the carpet and, you know, pretend it never happened. I have clients who I look at 7 years ago, and they were more digitally advanced than they are now. you know, they've developed none of their own media platforms to any degree. All of their activity has been on rented platforms, whether it was MySpace, Friendster, Facebook, you know, wherever it happens to be next, Twitter. You know, obviously you need to, you know, to use the horrible phrase, fish where the fish are, and sort of you need to be active in those channels, but you obviously need to also have your own presences, which you evolve over time. They help your visibility in terms of search, and, you know, there's a phenomenal amount you can do in that respect. So a lot of the time it's kind of pulling people back from the precipice of just doing the latest, craziest thing and actually going, you know, what do we want the brand to look like in 2 or 3 years' time digitally? You know, where do we want it to sit? Where should we put our investments? And if you look at someone like Red Bull, of course, they're phenomenally successful in social channels, but they also have .com, which is the hub. That's where all the content sits, and that's what gives them the long-term value and growth potential.
Yeah, they are a media company, after all. When we're dealing with creating a strategy with a brand, if you have a Red Bull or if you have maybe an Apple that has some higher mission, that a very specific point of view that galvanizes, it seems to make it a lot easier to have a digital strategy because it's something a little bit more, you can relate to it on a more human level. To what extent is it important in your work to have a brand that has a human level, a higher purpose? And if you don't have one, can you create an effective digital campaign?
I think Red Bull's, obviously, there are the examples that we all trot out all of the time. And I get incredibly, you know, if one more person talks to me about, well, Nike do this, therefore we should do it, or Harley Davidson, Apple, Red Bull, whoever it happens to be. The reality is, you know, those brands aren't typical. Most brands, if they attempt to do anything similar to that, would just fall flat on their face. But you can have purposes which are a bit more human and simple and not quite
missionary.
Yeah, they don't have to be as missionary. So, for example, if you look at Dove and their work around sort of body confidence, self-esteem, and, you know, women's role in society, not every FMCG brand can have that kind of high-level role. And actually, I've only got a certain amount of room in my life for brands that can tell those stories. Actually, a lot of the time, just having a little idea around, we want to be known for, you know, fun fashion for all, which you talk about Uniqlo or sort of Best Buy, just delighting people with new technologies. You know, you can take quite simple, mundane brands and actually give them quite spiky focus strategies which don't have to try and solve all of humanity's issues. But the trouble is, I think when you speak to most brand marketers, the average tenure of a brand marketer now in the UK is 18 months. You can speak to them and just ask them what the brand means, and it's kind of, they can't even answer that question, let alone.
And whatever they might answer will be different from the person sitting next door to them.
Yeah, and if you look at, I think, the, you know, some of the brands, so I sometimes work with Johnny Walker, and famously they had the same marketing manager on Johnny Walker for 15 years, and they also had a very long-standing relationship with BBH, which is obviously recently sort of finished, but or changed. And you see that, you know, sort of, by having consistently brilliant people working on something for a long time, you'll often see the outputs will improve on the back of that. Good work comes from good relationships. You know, I ironically do this thing telling people about the future of technology and communications, and that generally involves me standing in a room talking to them as if I was a Victorian school teacher. I'm slightly less, you know, more relaxed than that, and it's more interactive and workshoppy, but fundamentally, putting people in a room together, talented, creative people in a room together, often brings the best results.
So when we're talking, you mentioned Dove, part of a large organization. What type of angle do you have or challenges do you face when you're working with a brand in a large organization that has a corporate culture and then you have a specific brand culture, like Dove in particular has such a strong identity working in a large corporate organization? Do you have, had you faced that challenge before?
I think in an organization of that scale, you can have issues where, again, we look for proof points in the work. And if one brand does something, everyone wants to do it. And so, you know, the big thing 3 years ago was every brand was about participation and engagement. And actually, join
the conversation.
Yeah, join the conversation. of course, that's relevant for some people, but you get this groupthink that you happen within businesses where one person will do something, everyone else has to follow. And I think, you know, an interesting model is when you have these kind of SWAT teams within the business that almost run as separate startups, and they're given a huge amount of leeway and they can just do their own thing. Also, with some of the sort of global businesses I work with, you often have this situation where the closer to the mothership you are, the more... The more obedient the marketing teams will often be, and they will follow the party line. And then actually when you fly out to developing markets, Africa, China, South America, they're doing crazy stuff that they would rarely get through corporate, but actually it can really work. And then, you know, my job at that point is to decipher how that work came about and proliferate that work within the business.
And on top of that, they're probably doing it with less resources. If, you know, we're talking Africa with lower tech, but it can be so much more powerful and engaging, and you often find a much stronger employee engagement on the project than the ones who are closer to home, as you're saying.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, it comes back to this thing. We obsess with the latest, shiniest technology. And we're all thinking about 3D printing at the moment, but actually if you look at the use of SMS in Africa or the way WeChat's evolving in China, actually what you can do with fairly straightforward technologies, it's not the technology that's interesting, it's how we use them. It's observing these behaviors and just being a bit of an anthropologist and sort of keeping an eye on what's happening. I was in Hong Kong at the end of last year and just observing their use of mobile phones, just everyone being constantly on them. Of course, we like that in the West. In China, it's another level. Mm. You know, everyone's got selfie sticks, and you go on the tube, and it's absolutely jam-packed. And they're, you know, doing these incredibly ornate, writing out their messages or doing the sort of voice messages based on that. And it's actually just looking at those use of technology and sort of how not just companies, but also people are innovating.
Mm. You know? I even think, I mean, thinking about WeChat, how Twitter should be... waking up to how much more WeChat is innovative than Twitter is.
Yeah, of course. And I think, again, if you look at most new technologies, the inventor has no idea of how that technology eventually gets used. So if you look to SMS, it was a diagnostic tool for Nokia engineers to be able to send diagnostics between each other when a phone had broken. If you look at superglue, it was invented to keep, you know, during the war, to keep sort of stick wounds together. And actually, you know, Alexander Graham Bell famously said, I can foresee, I think this was him who quoted it, he said, I one day foresee a day when there will be a telephone in every major city in the United States.
Crazy guy.
And yeah, you know, who'd have thought a telephone in every city? And at that point, we thought telephones would be sending opera down from New York so the rest of the masses could listen and improve themselves through high culture. But actually, you know, it's the way we sort of morph and mess around with the technology, that's when things get quite fascinating.
Yeah, looking at the usages. So Tim, in your experience, when you're driving down the message in an organization, we talked about the creative director a little earlier.
Yeah.
What about the head, the CEO? To what extent do you believe the CEO needs to be completely understanding digital? Is that relevant in your perspective?
Yes. Yeah, of course. And one of the things that you can, you know, so a lot of my job, sometimes it's talking to large groups of brand marketing people. Sometimes it's doing one-to-one coaching with C-level executives. And a lot of that coaching morphs into therapy, which is basically, I don't understand the language that my subordinates are using. What the hell is this? How can I learn about it? And then you just have to, you know, my belief, which sort of... grew out of years of training and years at Apple, which was hands-on personal experience. Personal activation will breed professional understanding. So actually, if you're using these tools, if you're not afraid of them, if you can show people the benefits and give them that light bulb moment of, oh shit, that's why I want to use that, that's why that's really interesting to me, then you can unlock interest and engagement. But again, if I've spoken to you, and I've had three sessions over 3 months, if I then leave you in that position in stasis and you're not encouraged to constantly try this stuff out, then you'll get to a point 2 months later where you'll be afraid to put your head above the parapet, and you won't really, you know, again, most of that confidence would have dissolved. So actually you need to engender that sense of curiosity and interest in what people are sort of, what people are doing, and just give them the tools, show them, if you don't understand it, have the confidence to challenge people on your board about it. If they can't explain it simply, they probably don't understand it themselves. And actually, you know, just getting the CEO to start using Twitter will suddenly, it sounds like such a fatuous thing, but suddenly the rest of the business, everyone will suddenly be, they may not be tweeting, but they'll actually be listening to everything he says. They won't want to go into a meeting not knowing that stuff. Just getting people to set up a listening post on Hootsuite, which just has the key influencers, the key brands, your key competitors in four or five different columns, will just, you know, I'll check it before I go into a meeting, and I'll have a really good picture of what's the content being shared, what's interesting, what passions do people have around the brand or the idea. And from that, you know, you just feel slightly less unqualified than one would normally.
I mean, I love that idea. I mean, can you imagine having an agency meeting where everybody pre-meeting has to have looked at their wall of Hootsuite? I mean, that would be a beautiful thing.
But also you need to know what's the stock price of the business, what's keeping the marketing director awake at night, what's keeping the CEO awake at night. The CEO, a lot of the time you'll find, you know, they'll be in their 50s or 60s and they'll just try and sleepwalk into retirement without, you know, really fucking up the business. And actually, you know, their job is to, it's damage limitation and collateral sort of control. The visionary ones, and we work with a lot of these companies, are the people who actually just really wake up and say, you know what, things are shifting. Software is reinventing every business on earth. It's reinvented, it's, you know, publishing, music, film, video. What's next? You know, sort of journalism's going through this process. Education's about to go through it. Health's about to go through it. Advertising still behaves. If Don Draper walked into an ad agency today, it'd pretty much look the same way it did back in the 50s and 60s. There might be a screen in the reception which has some bubbles with some tweets and things in it, but beyond that, not much has changed.
So I hear you, and yet agencies still play such an important role in big brand business. If you're marketing in a company, what kind of advice would you give to them for dealing with their agencies better in order to get more effective, more punchy, more efficient anyway, campaigns?
Put people in a room together and make them work together. You know, agencies generally, and this doesn't matter whether you're talking about the social media, the traditional, the direct, the PR agencies, you know, they've all got their own agenda and they're all basically trying to carve out a larger slice of the pie. They're not very good at collaboration. And there's a very good reason for that, because they're not rewarded for it. And we've slightly covered that before. There's no easy answers to that. But actually, the best work comes from when you put people in a room and force them to work together. So if we think about, you know, the famous examples of the Old Spice response campaign, there you had the social media listening people, you had the creatives, the writers, the TV guys, and the data insights people all in the same room. And you basically banged heads together and get them to do that work. With Oreo, the Daily Twist, I think they got FCB Draft, 180, and about four different agencies. They get together every day for 100 days and each day come up with some new content. And that became the process that is now their social media. As far as I'm aware, that's the way they now sort of run their social media accounts. And that doesn't just work in a social space. It also works across, you know, just creating great integrated businesses across all of their outputs.
So, I mean, it's actually very exciting times. I mean, at the end of the day, there's a sort of an element of some people hiding, putting their head in the sand, trying to get rid of it before their retirement. But for the rest of us, it's an extremely exciting time, and there is so much change. You mentioned before the curiosity and staying up with what's going on. What kinds of tips can you give us as for a head person who would like to stay up with what's going on?
So 10 years ago, it would have been impossible for me to run my business with the small group of us that we have. You know, I would have to subscribe to lots of data insights, lots of trends reports, just be, you know, really aware of lots of technologies that you know, people weren't sharing before. More people are sharing more than they ever have done, and that's incredibly important. And the most important thing, find the interesting people, stalk them, follow them, meet them, just stay in touch with them. And actually, you know, I get in lots of trouble because I don't follow my sister on Twitter. I don't follow my friends on Twitter. They get really offended. But actually, Twitter for me is purely about inspiration, finding out new interesting stuff. I prune my Twitter feed incredibly regularly, and you know, I'm very time conscious of not spending too much time on it. I understand a lot of people don't use Twitter that way, but for me, just finding those 30 or 40 people, actually listening to them quite regularly, means that I get to hear their smart stuff and say it back to other people, and other people think I'm way more intelligent than I actually am. And I think it's just, you know, it's just being a sponge. It's just being curious and interested in what's happening at the moment. We are working in one of the most challenging times our industry has ever faced, but the opportunities are absolutely phenomenal. And actually, if you can get the slam dunk within the business, if you can have that big win, then, you know, it's the best thing you're ever going to be able to do for your career and your future prospects. And actually, you know, that's what I try to help happen, encourage the give people the confidence to actually sort of think differently, try different things, and try things in new ways, which will hopefully change the outputs, you know, because if the people, the process and the inputs don't change, then obviously nothing else is going to change. We need to change the stimulation, we need to change the approach and the strategy, and then with the right people and the right levels of knowledge, we have a chance of creating some really interesting work.
So if you would like some more spark in your change and wanted to track down Tim Spark, how would you like people to connect with you?
I listen on Twitter a lot. I don't say that much, but at Sparky, S-P-A-R-K-E-Y on Twitter is probably a good place to start, and then come to Congregation, have a look at the website, which is congregation.io, and yeah, just get in touch.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes on themindset.com, that's mindset with a Y, where you can also sign up for my weekly newsletter at /subscribe. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes. That really makes my day. Happy trails, and enjoy Josh Sachs's Painted Fingers.
Oh, fill me with all your colors any different way to rid me of the gray and heal me with all your imperfections that you mention in your lack of self-security. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm, wrapped in canvas, hold me tightly, slowly we would paint a lover's portrait with all your favorite shades, and we'd paint blend and look ugly in the end, but they're pretty in their own disgusting values. We'd hang our portraits in the hallways, make our house guests cringe. Oh, I wouldn't care about the art form as long as you would feel warm seeing all your colors.
All these limitations, all the
with all your favorite shades, and we paint it with our fingers to show the world the way we feel. Oh, oh, the way I feel.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.